This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The movie Battleship, based on the board game, opens today in the U.S. It is familiar summer fare. It has firepower on a military scale. It has ear-punishing pyrotechnics. It has aliens, and it even has Liam Neeson. But Bob Mondello says, in one respect, Battleship is an outlier.
Weapons tight. On everything loaded.
Battleship may not be any good, but it is undeniably ours. American from the Water Up, a Universal Studios picture about an alien invasion, crammed with special effects from industrial light and magic, and set largely on American warships. Still, while this sci-fi epic is definitely homegrown, American audiences are the last ones on Earth who are getting to see it. Battleship first hoisted anchor 6 weeks ago in Japan. It cruised to Europe a week later, then steamed into Russia and Pakistan, and has since docked in every movie port of call on the planet except the U.S., Canada, and Paraguay. That release plan would have been unthinkable a decade or so ago when it was a given that a Hollywood film opened first in the U.S., but American box office has remained basically stable for the last decade, while overseas box office has skyrocketed. And with most blockbusters now earning twice as much overseas as they do in this country, it makes sense to take advantage of scheduling quirks elsewhere.
Guys, I'm bringing the party to you.
The Avengers, for instance, opened here on May 4th, but it opened a week earlier in 39 other countries because May 1st is a national holiday in most of the world, Labor Day. May Day crowds everywhere from France to Brazil to Hong Kong helped the avenging superheroes earn almost $200 million for their labors before they nailed down the biggest opening weekend in American history. And while it took Battleship 6 weeks rather than one, it's done much the same thing. This isn't a magic bullet, though. Sometimes it's good for a film to open here and get an international buzz going before it heads overseas.
The time has come to select one courageous young man and woman for the honor of representing District 12 in the 74th annual Hunger Games.
Industry observers say that the Hunger Games, which was a massive hit with all age groups in this country, might have benefited internationally had it waited a week or two to open elsewhere. That way, the big American opening would have raised the film's profile with older audiences overseas, and it might have played to more than just teenagers initially. The reverse can also happen. The animated kid flick Rio, for example, is thought to have benefited here from a sort of international tryout tour.
The only other blue macaw is in Rio de Janeiro.
Brazil?
School holidays in other countries led to Rio opening overseas a week before it opened in the U.S., and it was a smash, that weekend's biggest opening worldwide. The American press picked up on the film's success, and a kid flick that had been struggling to make an impression opened a good deal better than expected.
What are you doing?
Getting out of here.
I can't.
What? You can't what?
Oh, I can't.
This sort of thing also happens with pictures aimed at older audiences. Later this summer, The Amazing Spider-Man will amaze Japan and New Zealand 5 days before it amazes the U.S. And if you've been waiting decades for Ridley Scott to make a prequel to Alien and just can't wait any longer, now you'll have an option. Hop on a plane to Europe.
Whatever that probe is picking up, it's reading life form.
Ridley Scott's Prometheus will open a week early in Europe to get ahead of soccer's Euro Cup, which its producers think will be a huge distraction for their male target audience. If, on the other hand, you're desperate to see the new Bourne movie, the first one without Matt Damon, stay right where you are.
Welcome to the program.
The Bourne legacy may globetrot all over the world, but it will open in the U.S. on August 3rd and won't reach most of the locations where it was shot until almost a month later. I'm Bob Mondello.
Time for Major League Baseball. Now that the bats are really cracking, we're going to check in on how the teams and some key players are shaping up. We're joined now, as we are most Fridays, by sports writer Stefan Fatsis. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
Let's start with some breaking news. It was reported today that Kerry Wood, the hard-throwing Chicago Cubs pitcher, has decided to retire after 14 seasons.
Yeah, I still think of Wood as that 20-year-old rookie who struck out 20 Houston Astros in 1998 in just the fifth start of his career. But then you also think about the arm trouble that derailed his promise time and time again. He missed the 1999 season after he had Tommy John elbow surgery. He had repeated shoulder and other problems. He did remake himself as a reliever, and after a couple of seasons elsewhere, returned to Chicago, where he is beloved. He struggled this year. He was so frustrated that he tossed his glove and cap into the stands last week at Wrigley Field after a bad performance. Kerry Wood will go down as one of those athletes that you wonder just how good he could have been.
Yeah, Kerry Wood's career reminds us of how hard it is to predict who will do very well in Major League Baseball. One player whom you could always count on to do incredibly well was Albert Pujols. But he is off to a terrible start with his new team, the Los Angeles Angels, this season.
Yeah. Pujols left the St. Louis Cardinals after 11 seasons. He signed a 10-year, $240 million contract with the Angels. He's in the worst slump of his career. 38 games so far, just 3 home runs and 18 runs batted in. His batting average, on-base percentage, slugging percentage, they're all anemic. He has averaged 44 home runs per season over his career. He's on pace this season, Robert, for 13. Mm-hmm. Look, this is probably just a slow start. He has hit 2 home runs this week, so maybe it's ending. But this has definitely hurt his team. The Angels are already 7 games behind the division-leading Texas Rangers.
Speaking of the Rangers, their slugger is having no problems whatever, to put it mildly. Josh Hamilton is on a pace that could be described as the very opposite of Pujols.
Yeah, with Pujols, we're getting these articles quoting other sluggers saying, hang in there, we've all been through slumps. With Josh Hamilton, we're getting stories about whether he's going to win the Triple Crown. He leads the American League in all 3 categories, the batting categories, average 399, home runs 18, runs batted in 45. We mentioned pace. Hamilton is on pace to break Barry Bonds' record of 73 homers in a season. Last week, he became just the 16th player in Major League history to hit 4 home runs in 1 game. You know how in Little League, there's always one big kid who looks like he doesn't belong? Josh Hamilton is treating the major leagues that way. The big question with him, though, has always been injuries. He's had a full season just once in his 6 years in the big leagues.
And the Rangers are more than just Josh Hamilton, too.
Yeah, they've scored the most runs in baseball. They've also given up the fewest runs in the American League, so their pitching has been phenomenal. Yu Darvish of Japan, whom we talked about before the season started, the Rangers committed more than $100 million to bring him over from Japan during the offseason. He has been better than advertised. He's won 6 of his first 8 starts, struck out 58 batters in 52 innings.
Darvish is not the only new, or at least newish, player making an impact this season. In Washington, D.C., right here, we have a couple.
Yeah, who knew? Baseball in Washington. Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg. Harper is the Washington Nationals' 19-year-old outfielder who made his major league debut 3 weeks ago. He's been busy. Homered in back-to-back games, was intentionally hit by a pitch thrown by Cole Hamels of the Philadelphia Phillies, who was then suspended. Harper stole home in the same game. He took 10 stitches above an eye after slamming a bat against a dugout wall. And then he became a YouTube sensation when he showed up on the National Mall during an office softball game and took a couple of swings.
Reminiscent of Willie Mays playing stickball in the streets of Harlem when he first came to New York.
Exactly. And then you got Strasburg, who's been sensational on the pitching mound after coming back from elbow surgery. The two of them, one of the main reasons there's hope in Washington for baseball. The city has not watched a postseason game since 1933.
Well, Stefan, enjoy a weekend of interleague play, hockey playoffs, NBA playoffs, and the Preakness. Enjoy yourself.
Thanks, Robert.
That's Stefan Fatsis, who joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. You can hear more of him on Slate.com's sports podcast. Hang up and listen. Well, now, politics with our regular Friday crew, columnists E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of the New York Times. Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Everywhere you turn this week, there seems to be some point of tension between capitalism and democracy. There are questions about the balance between bankers on Wall Street and regulators in Washington, and the balance between rich and poor countries in Europe, or, as we'll hear in this clip from Vice President Biden this week, the balance between manufacturing jobs, which he says the president wants to create, and more growth in the financial sector, where Mitt Romney made his millions.
You know the difference between an economy, as I said, that's built on making things rather than on collateralized debt, creative credit default swaps, financial instruments like subprime mortgages. That's not how you build an economy. You build an economy by building things. Ladies and gentlemen,
E.J. Dionne, in that speech in Youngstown, Ohio, Vice President Biden went after Mitt Romney as someone who's not on your side. What's noteworthy about this speech?
Well, I think the debate on Mitt Romney and Bain Capital will give us the debate we might have had after the crash in 2008 and 2009. And that is, have we radically shifted the rewards in our economy toward the masters of the financial world and away from all other parts of the economy, including manufacturing? How much, for example, did all of this financial innovation help the broader economy, and how much did it just help a very, very narrow group of people? And we're also looking at what these takeovers mean when companies get sort of saddled with lots of debt. And so I think this is a very fundamental argument about what kind of capitalism do we want in the United States. And I think that's a good argument to have, and it's one we have often had through our history.
David Brooks, a good argument or just an attempt to vilify Mitt Romney?
Well, it's a good argument. I think Obama and Biden are going to have to do a little better. The Biden comment was illiterate, economically illiterate on multiple levels. If he thinks American manufacturing is divorced from American capital markets, he's got another thing coming. It's not just a blacksmith in a garage. It's companies using capital markets in very sophisticated ways. The second thing is manufacturing output is high. Our manufacturing output is actually doing extremely well, including exports. The problem is employment is low because they become so productive. I think Romney should be happy to have a debate about Bain, because the Obama campaign ran an ad, which also I thought was a bit illiterate, about a company called GSD Steel that closed. And this was a company that was in dire straits, had lost most of its workforce. Bain put in some money. They invested $100 million. They hung on to it for 8 years. It ended up failing anyway. But that's part of the creative destructive process of capitalism. And I suspect, like E.J., we're going to have a big debate about creative destruction and how it's done.
Could I just quickly say, on the matter of literacy, the issue here is not, do companies need capital markets? Of course they need capital markets. The issue here is whether all of these new financial inventions have actually benefited the real economy, or have they benefited a very small number of people. And on manufacturing, yes, we have finally turned again toward rebuilding American manufacturing. I think that's a good thing, and I hope that's something that is also talked about a lot in the campaign.
Speaking of the financial sector, David, do you think that the problems at J.P. Morgan Chase, where the Wall Street Journal now estimates the bank's losses could rise to $5 billion, does it change the debate about financial regulation in the banks?
I think only maybe a fifth of the way. First of all, being stupid is not illegal. Failing and losing money is part of capitalism. And what happened is Morgan has taken this huge hit. A lot of people, or some people, have lost their jobs, the people who supervised that operation. And so they've taken a hit. And we should not care about that. We should not try to regulate failure out of existence. That's part of the capitalist process. The thing we have to do is make sure banks of that size do not spread. And so to this degree, I do agree with the Obama administration and with most Republicans.
I mean, do not spread, do not get any bigger? Or
do not become contagious toward other firms. Mm-hmm. And therefore, asking them to raise capital requirements so that they can survive hits like this, that seems to me a legitimate job, especially when you have firms that are too big to fail.
EJ?
There are different kinds of being stupid. If David and I are stupid, our listeners or readers can yell back at us. If a bank is stupid with large sums of money, they can destroy or bring down the American economy. And it was stupid bets and stupid things that happened before the crash that had something to do with the economic mess we're in, which is why I prefer boring banks to interesting banks. And that's what economic regulation is for. So I do think that this event will help the argument for stronger regulation.
We don't want you guys to be boring. That's not
or stupid.
Speaking of a lot of money, by the way, $100 billion has been spent on buying stock in Facebook, although that defies any ratio of value to earnings. David?
Mark Zuckerberg is now worth almost as much as Harvard's endowment. So that's not so bad.
Got a lot out of that education up there.
Yeah, it's dropping out. You know, to me, the big question is Facebook good or bad for America? Good or bad for the world? People logging on and having half their social life. And my quick rule is it's not Facebook, it's what you bring to Facebook. Most young people use Facebook as a way to augment pretty healthy friendships. About 10 or 20% use Facebook, they're lonely, and they use Facebook to mask that loneliness. So to me, one of the interesting interesting questions. Are we being ruined by Facebook? Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of an optimist. I think in general, Facebook is making our friendships better. And if Mark Zuckerberg wants all that money, fine.
I want to hear from both of you on some of what Scott Horsley was talking about, the European crisis. Right now, Greece has both a debt crisis and a political crisis. And it raises a question that, David, you addressed in a column today, which is, can any government that's subject to election and that reads the polls every day tell its people, here's the plan, guys. We've got to get poorer for the next 10 years.
Yeah, both the U.S. and Europe have been living beyond our means. So how do you rebalance? The Europeans have a very concentrated technocratic system. The problem is it's entirely cut off from the people. We have a very fragmented system where a lot of people have veto. And so right now, to me, the answer is neither. Government system looks particularly promising for getting us out of this long mess. It's going to be a bad decade on both sides of the Atlantic.
EJ.
I never disagreed with David more fundamentally than I did today, but I can't go into all of that. I think no kind of government, democratic or not, is good at allocating scarcity, which is why it is so urgent to create growth again in Europe. And I don't think this is a crisis of the welfare state. It's a crisis of the failure of capitalism, which has created the problem these European governments face.
EJ Dionne, David Brooks, good to see you once again.
Good to see you.
Take care. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Dozens of world leaders are gathering in Chicago this weekend for a NATO summit. So, too, are thousands of protesters. In fact, small anti-war and anti-NATO rallies have been taking place all week. The biggest demonstration so far happened this afternoon. It was organized by nurses. NPR's David Shaper explains why they're protesting.
Hello, everyone.
Jean Ross, a co-president of the National Nurses United, walked onto the stage in Daly Plaza, downtown Chicago, just after noontime, and immediately cut to the chase with the question many who are not part of the nurses' organization probably had on their minds.
Now, why? Does anyone know why we chose Chicago for our third annual staff nurse assembly? The G8, right. Where is the G8? Ooh, did they get frightened away?
Originally, President Obama had wanted to host overlapping summit meetings in his hometown of the eight biggest economic powers, the countries known as the G8, along with the leaders of the 28 nations in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But the G8 meetings were moved to Camp David, where they will wrap up tomorrow. The nurses and other groups wanting to protest economic inequalities kept their plans to come to Chicago. For the nurses, that meant becoming a sea of red and green, as they wore red hospital scrubs and green felt Robin Hood hats to promote what they call the Robin Hood tax. Roseanne DeMoro is executive director of National Nurses United.
It's a financial transaction tax. Some call it a financial speculation tax, but it's basically on trading. Hyper-trading for the most part at Wall Street.
DeMoro says the proposed tax would be half a cent for every $100 transaction.
What the nurses see every day at their bedside is the total human devastation and the cost of this economy on their patients' health and on their patients' lives.
The rally drew thousands of other protesters, some whose causes mirror the economic and health concerns of the nurses, other opposing war, NATO air and drone strikes in the Middle East, and other issues. Among them are Gwen Sari and Mary Kay Flanagan of Chicago.
I'm 77.
And you are?
Just turned 80.
Sari and Flanagan are both nuns with the Catholic Eighth Day Center for Justice. And to them, it makes sense that nurses are protesting NATO.
Because the money that's going to support war is money that could be used for health care and education.
You know, NATO's involved in so much injury of so many people with the wars and the drones, and nurses are about healing, so it's no leap there.
As this first major protest of the NATO weekend in Chicago wrapped up, hundreds from other groups took to the streets and marched around downtown Chicago. They tied up traffic, but no major incidents are reported. There is a heavy police presence all throughout downtown and along the city's lakefront. Barricades and hundreds of officers on foot, on horses, and on bicycles surrounded the nurses' rally and the protest march, as they likely will for every protest throughout the NATO summit. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
It's been nearly a year since the space shuttle program ended, and while Americans may have fretted over the crushed dreams of kids hoping to grow up and become astronauts, a private company, SpaceX, has been moving forward. Tomorrow morning, SpaceX will attempt its first mission to the International Space Station. The Falcon 9 rocket will launch an unmanned spacecraft from Cape Canaveral. Astrophysicist and NPR blogger Adam Frank thinks this is huge. If all goes as planned, he says, our real space age will begin.
So what's the big deal? Well, the Falcon 9 is a private spaceship, fully developed and owned by the private company SpaceX. And SpaceX is the brainchild of Elon Musk, the internet billionaire who made his fortune from PayPal. With contracts from NASA to develop new launch platforms, SpaceX and other companies are poised to make space the domain of profitable businesses. And Musk has been explicit about his intentions to go beyond Earth orbit, to build commercially viable ventures that might take people to Mars in a decade or two. His timing couldn't be any better or any more urgent. Even without the space shuttle, America needs to remain a leader in space. Now, when I was a kid, the U.S. space program fueled my imagination and led me into a life of science. But as I got older, it became clear that the real business of getting a human presence across the solar system was going to have to fall to business. Governments might get the exploration of space started, but the vagaries of election and budget cycles meant they could never go further. Now, we've reached the point where it's the exploitation of space that matters. And while exploitation might seem a dirty word to some folks, they should stop to consider how dependent we are already on the commercialization of that region of space we call low Earth orbit. Think of the billions of dollars in commercial activity tied to weather prediction, global broadcasting, and global positioning. All this business depends on satellites orbiting overhead right now. But if, as a species, we want to go beyond the thin veil of space directly overhead, then the basic principles of private venture and risk will have to apply. These are the ones that have always applied. While Queen Isabella may have given Columbus his ships to cross the Atlantic, it was private companies that built the seagoing trade routes and brought folks across to settle, for better or worse. Likewise, it's only through commercially viable endeavors that large numbers of humans are getting off this world and into the high frontier of space. It's no small irony that the billionaires bankrolling the new space entrepreneurship built their fortunes not in jet fighter aerospace manufacturing, but in the dream space of the internet. Like so many of the post-Apollo generation, myself included, these former high-tech whiz kids had their visions of the future forged in rocket fire. In that way, the wide vista of their dreams is uniquely American. While no one can doubt that problems enough exist here on Earth, the high frontier of space has always called to us as a nation. In stepping out across that threshold, who knows what new solutions we might imagine, what new expressions of our own creativity we might invoke. But none of it will happen unless we get out there. I am counting on that small step that SpaceX will take tomorrow to one day prove to be a giant leap for us all.
That's astrophysicist Adam Frank. He looks up at space longingly from the University of Rochester.